Those of us who are old enough to remember World War II would be familiar with the expression, there's a war on. During that war, there were many, many hardships from the civilian's point of view, at least. Nearly everything was rationed. You could only get one pair of shoes a year. Sugar was rationed. Meat was rationed. Gasoline was rationed. 3 gallons, I think it was, a month. We've had to give up a good many things. And when somebody complained about it, very often it was said, don't you know there's a war on? There were sacrifices to be made. There were hardships to be endured. We've had some wars since then, but most of them have been fought on distant battlefields, and people locally have hardly known there was a war on. There's another war that has been going since the time of Adam and Eve. It's a war between good and evil. It's a war between right and wrong. It's a war between truth and error. It's a war between unbelief and belief. But a great many people don't realize that there's a war going on because the battle is the Lord's. And faith is not strong even in the existence of the Lord, much less in His cause. That must be recognized and endured in order for us to really be at war as God would intend us to be. Sometimes these battles have involved marching armies that have faced one another. At other times, they have involved individuals who were struggling with some evil about against which they had to demonstrate their courage, their faith. Actually, the story we're studying this morning, at least beginning with, and I'll put you on notice that that's the case, involves both of these. It's in the 17th chapter of the book of 1 Samuel. And I'd like for you to turn there with me, and we're going to look at some things relating to this war that is in progress. A war that involves many, many battles, thousands, perhaps millions of battles over the years. And it's true that in a war, some battles are won, and often some battles are lost. We know the victor in this war eventually, but we don't know what direction each battle will take. The picture is very clearly established in the first few three verses of 1 Samuel 17. The Philistines gathered their armies together to battle, were gathered at Socah, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephes-Damon. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. You can imagine those two armies facing each other, actually each of them on a kind of mountain with a valley between. In fact, that's what's stated in the next verse. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side. Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley between them. But those armies didn't clash, interestingly enough. There was a proposal made that I've sometimes thought made some sense. Rather than causing all these people to die, just choose a couple of champions and let them do the fighting. That's exactly what was proposed by the Philistines. Of course, they had an unfair advantage because they had a giant who was to be their champion. And we read about him as we begin in verse 4. The champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. No wonder. I have to carry all that. Then he stood and cried to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, Then you'll be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. Big bully. Bigger than anybody else. More armor than anybody else. He's challenging someone to fight. Well, how did the Israelites react? You'll see their reaction in verse 11. When Saul and Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. You can understand that. Well, on this occasion, a young shepherd boy arrives. He's not in the army, actually. His father, a distant place, has three sons in the army. He's concerned about them. And so he calls his young son, David, out from tending the sheep and sends them to the army to carry some provisions. They didn't borrow money from the government in those days to feed the soldiers. Each family provided provisions for the servants and the soldiers in the army. And so he sent David to bring these provisions for these brothers. When David arrived, he heard what was going on. He was dismayed to hear this man as he spoke against the armies of the Lord. There were many reasons for him to be uninvolved. After all, he wasn't a soldier. And he was very young. And he wasn't trained in war. And he didn't have the kind of armor that this man had. And, well, you could just go on and on giving reasons why he ought to stand back and say, why didn't somebody do something? You soldiers, what's the matter with you? King Saul, why don't you go out and fight him? You're head and shoulders above all the rest of these soldiers you have. But David didn't reason that way. Actually, David volunteered to go and fight that giant. Now, why do you suppose David volunteered to go and fight that giant? It's unreasonable that he should do that. But he did. And he gives his reason in verse 47. He said, the battle is the Lord's. Now, what do we mean when we say that the battle is the Lord's? Well, in the first place, it was God's kind of battle. There are a lot of battles that we get very, very concerned about, very anxious about, that are really not the Lord's battles. We can get terribly excited about who's going to win a football game. And even perhaps to the point of being inclined to pray about it. But I don't think God cares who wins a football game. That's not one of God's battles. When political parties are face to face, sometimes there may be some moral principles involved, but many times it's nothing more than politics. Even when countries are fighting one another, most of the time I don't think God's involved. I don't know. Sometimes when God's involved, it's using the worst people to discipline the better people, as we learn from the Old Testament. So we don't know which side God's on, even when there's a war going on between nations, when there's a struggle between labor and management. That's not God's kind of battle at all. But this was God's kind of battle, because it involved God's people and the Philistines. It involved those who worshiped God and those who were ridiculing God. In fact, this giant comes out ridiculing God, ridiculing God's people. And David is very concerned about that. Believing it was God's battle, he believed God would help him. In fact, when Saul questioned his ability to go out and do this, in verse 37 he says, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he'll deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. He had absolute confidence that though he was just a boy, unarmed, untrained, small, that he could defeat this giant because he believed that God was with him. And finally, it was God's battles, not David's. So it was God who was to receive the glory and not David. But the one thing that I really want to drive home in this lesson this morning is this fact. That David had to do something. It's mighty easy for us to say, well, this is God's battle. We just let God take care of it. Well, God can defeat the enemy, but he requires the willingness of soldiers to fight, of individuals to allow themselves to be used by God to accomplish what God wants to have accomplished. Well, the battle took place, and what happened? Look with me at the beginning at verse 38 and see the preparation that David made. Saul clothed David with his armor. This guy is coming with this all of this huge armor. David, you're going to need some armor too. So Saul the king clothed David with his armor, put a bronze helmet on his head, also clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. He wasn't accustomed to wearing all that armor. David said to Saul, I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them. So David took them off, and he did what he was accustomed to doing, what he was capable of doing, what he knew he could do. He took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had made, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Well, Goliath advanced. He comes forth, and what does he say? Well, he came forth and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. You can almost imagine a human tank coming forth for you with all of that huge amount of armor. When the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him. Well, he was only a youth, ruddy and good-looking. So the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and beasts of the field. Talk about trash talk. That's trash talk, isn't it? But David responded, and from one point of view, it sounds trashy too, but it's the talk of faith, not the talk of trash. David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. You've defied God, you've defied His armies. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines, to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the field, and all the earth shall know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear. For, as he said, the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Note the goals that he expresses. That the earth may know there's a God in Israel. And that this assembly shall know that the Lord doesn't save with a sword and shield. There's a God in Israel. And he has power. And he can win, no matter how humble the servant may be. And that servant doesn't have to be armed with a sword and a spear. If God is with him, he has the power to win. And what was the outcome? Well, beginning with verse 48, it was that when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. He wasn't afraid. He advanced. Then David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, perhaps the only place that wasn't protected, so that the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword, and drew it out of its sheath, and killed him, cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The battle was won, but it was won when God used a shepherd boy, unarmed, untrained, but willing to accomplish his purpose. So many of the great battles of the Old Testament were won because of the courage and the willingness of one individual. What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, and Samson, and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quench the violence of the fire, escape the age of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, and turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Very often, one individual whom God used. God's battles now are not physical battles. You remember that Jesus, when he was before Pilate, answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." The Apostle Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 10:4 and 5, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds." What kind of strongholds? "Casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." And then again in Ephesians the 6th chapter, verses 11 and 12, "Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood." Our fight is not with some individual physically, but our fight is against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And God needs Davids today just as surely as he did then. Not with a slingshot and a small stone, but with truth, which Jesus said can make men free. We have some New Testament battles that may not be as dramatic to our minds as was the dramatic victory of David over Goliath. Christ's battle with Satan in the Mount of Temptations was a far more significant battle even than the battle between David and Goliath. He met Satan, and Satan was seeking every way he could to bring Jesus to sin. And if Jesus had sinned on that occasion, the terrible consequences would have been far greater than the defeat of the armies of Israel. And when Jesus was in the garden, again he was tempted. I believe there's no question that Satan was using his flesh to tempt him to try to escape the cross. But again, Jesus refused, saying, "Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." And I don't think I've mentioned here the cross, but during the Lord's Supper, I was thinking about the victory of the cross when Satan was able to bruise the heel of Jesus, but when Jesus bruised the head of Satan and gained the absolute certainty of final victory over Satan and all his forces. Actually, when you think about it, Stephen's battle with Satan in the 7th chapter of Acts was a significant battle. And both these battles, the battle of Jesus and the battle of Stephen, were clearly God's battles. When Jesus was tempted and when Jesus was in the garden, in both instances, God sent angels to comfort him when he had won the battle. And in the instance of Stephen, as they were stoning him after he had spoken the truth of Jesus, and they began to stone him, he looked up and saw Jesus standing at the right hand of God. His servant Stephen had courageously and forcefully defeated the doctrines, the teaching, the abuses of the leaders of the Jews. Jesus was concerned, and he was standing at the right hand of God for the comfort of his servant Stephen. That was truly a victory as significant as that of David. You say, a victory? That was like a defeat. He died, and Jesus died. Yes, but physical death is not defeat when it is accomplished for God's glory. And in both instances, God's will was accomplished. Jesus' death on the cross purchased salvation for the whole human race who will accept him. And Stephen's death led to the scattering of God's people and the preaching of the gospel in the world, which was really the purpose that God had in mind from the very beginning of time. We're both fighting Satan. You and I have constant struggles with the error and the sin that's around us. Sometimes you hear God's name questioned, God's existence questioned. This is a challenge to a battle. What do we do about it? Sometimes we hear morality ridiculed. What do we do about it? Sometimes we hear God's people criticized as narrow-minded and Paul was called a fool for Christ. And sometimes God's people are called that today. What do we do about it? Do we say, I'm too young? Do we say, I'm not armed? I'm not trained? Where's a preacher somewhere that can come and deal with this? Well, if there's someone nearby who is better qualified to deal with it, let him deal with it, but back him up. Let him know you stand with him. But if there's no one else, let me be a David and come with what little I may know and what little preparation I may have had, and let me stand up for Jesus. Mason, did you see what I was going to preach on this morning? I really had already looked up the number in that book to say, Mason, we've missed a song. Let's sing Stand Up for Jesus. And that's exactly what you led. Stand up for Jesus. That's what we need to be prepared to do, even when we do not feel capable of it. But you know, it's not only when some great truth is challenged and great armies perhaps are standing, waiting, listening to see what will be said or what will be done. Sometimes the battle takes place within our own heart. Back in the book of James, the 4th chapter and verse 1, he says, where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? Sometimes the battle takes place within our own heart. And we must realize that when we're tempted to, perhaps to sexual impurity, or when we're tempted to drink something that really will destroy our ability to think, or perhaps to smoke something, or to inject something, or that is going to destroy our control of ourselves, of this body that God's given us, that's a battle. That's a battle. And what are we going to do about it? And then when we are led to compromise in order to perhaps get a better salary, or maybe to make some money that we could obtain by cooking the books or in some other way doing something dishonest, that's a battle. Satan is pressing for obedience, just as he pressed Jesus for obedience. And then when there is a pride of life, perhaps people will ridicule me if I do this or do that. Perhaps I'll lose some kind of a promotion that I want. And in order to get this promotion, I'm going to have to do something that's not quite right. How do I react? I'm facing a giant, just as David faced a giant. And the question is, am I going to have the courage to stand up for what's right and to do what's right? And you may say, the battle is the Lord's. Yes, the battle is the Lord's. And God is concerned. I know that He's concerned. And that was the first test we had about David, wasn't it? He knew it was God's battle because it was the kind of battle God's concerned with. And when we're standing against those who are criticizing God or criticizing God's people, God's concerned. Or when I'm tempted personally, God is concerned. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. That's one of the most remarkable passages in the New Testament, I think. That God is in control. You remember back in the book of Job that God put restraints on the devil. He first said, you can touch his property, but you can't touch his body. And then God said, you can touch his body, but you can't touch his life. God won't allow Satan to go beyond a certain point. God is concerned when we stand in battle with Satan, and He's not going to allow us to be tempted beyond what we're able to bear. He's watching out for His soldier out there on the battlefield. It's His battle. He's concerned. And in addition to that, we have another statement that it is God's, we can depend on God's help. Now to Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. Don't you expect that's what Saul felt after David won? God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all I ever expected out of this boy. It wasn't the boy. It was God that accomplished what He accomplished. And then the third question that we asked was, will God receive the glory? Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But I want you to notice this fact that we tried to emphasize with David. We must let God use us. God is not going to just fight the battle and give us the credit for it unless we are willing to step forward and let God use us. Look back at those three verses. God is concerned, and He won't let Satan tempt us beyond what we're able to bear, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape. That involves me. The question is, am I going to take that way of escape? He's not just going to fight it for me. He says, I'm going to resist Satan. I'm going to control Satan. But I'm going to give you a way to get away. And the question is, will I get away? Do I want to get away from temptation? Lead us not into temptation. And yet sometimes we go just as close to the temptation as we can. There's something attractive about the temptation. And we get just as close as we can. No. God gives us a way of escape, and He expects us to take it. Praying, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And we can depend on God. I prepared a sermon one time on this passage. To Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. And I'd left out that last part. And I had to go back to the drawing board after I realized it. It's according to the power that works in us. We either let it work in us or we don't. God's power was available just as much for King Saul and for every one of those soldiers as it was for David. But only David was willing to allow the power of God to work in him. And this last one, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But I have to do. I have to come forth. I have to be prepared to act and depend on God. I can't just sit back and let God take care of His own battles. I have to be the willing soldier that David was. No wonder then, the Scriptures say, fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life to which you were also called and have confessed the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. Fight the good fight of faith. Fighting is not easy. Fighting is not pleasant for peace-loving people like most of us are. Fighting involves pain. Fighting often involves injury. Fighting in some instances, as in the case of Stephen, involved death. But nevertheless, fight the good fight of faith. That's our responsibility, regardless of what the cost, the difficulty, the hardship may be involved. But suppose I decide, well, I'm not going to fight this battle. I'm just going to let this battle go. You remember back in the Old Testament that the people of God, the Jews, were threatened with total annihilation in the days of Esther. And Mordecai appealed to the only person who, in likelihood, was able to, appeared to at least, to be able to save them. And that was Esther, who was the queen at that time. And when Mordecai suggested to Esther that she needed to act, she pointed out that when you go to the king, if he doesn't hold out his scepter to you, it's death. If I just go in there, and he doesn't want to see me, I'm out of here. Well, what did Mordecai say? If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. If God has a battle to be fought, and it is a battle that must be won, God will find somebody to fight it. But if we refuse, then we are going to suffer consequences. He said, if you refuse, you and your father's house will perish. God will take care of what needs to be cared for, but you'll suffer the consequences. And yet he said, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. David had come to the battle for such a time as he came. We don't really know what would have happened if David hadn't come on the scene. Did he just happen to come there? I have no way of always of knowing what God has done, what God hasn't done. And I can't say for sure. There was no miracle in his being there. But he was there. And he was the man of the hour, though he didn't appear to be. And if you are in a situation where there is some strife, some struggle between good and error, even when you are facing Satan in the privacy of your own living room or office or wherever you are, who knows but what you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And you don't know what a victory over Satan may accomplish, not only for you, but for others as well. The whole army was saved because David was willing to struggle with that giant. And many, many times what seem to be insignificant battles can prove to be the most important battles of the war. And it's for us to stand up for Jesus, ye soldiers of the cross. To stand up for Jesus, you first have to surrender. You have to surrender to Jesus. I read one time that in order to be a great leader, you have to learn first to be a good follower. And if you're going to stand up for Jesus, the first thing you have to do is surrender to Him completely. When a soldier goes into the Army, or the Marines particularly, what's the first thing they do? They try to destroy his will and make him ready to follow his leader, regardless of what the leader may require. And if you are a true follower of Jesus, a true soldier of the cross, it's because you're ready to do whatever Jesus says, not questioning the wisdom of it, not questioning the difficulty of it, but simply obeying, submitting immediately. Are you willing to say, all to Jesus I surrender, all to Him I freely give? If you're ready to do that, He says, you must repent and be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for remission of sin. And we remain happy and eager to help you in that as we stand and sing to encourage you.